Today on the 21st, with the coronavirus continuing to spread across the United States, people are being told to stay home if they feel sick. But what about people who don't have any paid sick days to use? We'll discuss the health and economic costs of not offering paid sick leave. Plus, with Illinois' primary election just 1 week away, we'll take a look at the primary races in the state's 15th and 17th congressional districts, and a conversation with Illinois' most recent poet laureates.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up today on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Later on the show, we'll preview the primary races in Illinois' 15th and 17th congressional districts just 1 week before the election, and a conversation with two Illinois poet laureates. But first, cases of the coronavirus have now spread to 35 states. That means an increasing number of workers across the country will have to stay home to care for themselves or a sick loved one. And for a majority of Americans, doing so could harm their paycheck. Just 12 states in the U.S. currently require employers to provide paid sick leave, and Illinois is not among them, although some cities like Chicago have passed their own measures. Our next guest, Robert Bruno, says that this lack of paid sick leave puts more people at risk during a global health crisis like the coronavirus. He's a professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois. Professor Bruno, welcome back to the 21st.
It's nice to be back. Thank you, Brian.
Also joining us is Washington Post data reporter Christopher Ingram. He recently wrote about the economic costs of not offering paid sick leave. Christopher, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Professor Bruno, let's start with you. Roughly one in four Americans has paid sick leave. Is that about how it looks here in Illinois?
The last estimates that we've had in Illinois actually indicate that roughly 44% of workers go without paid sick days. So that would certainly place us well above the number that you just cited. And in fact, that 44% number of workers without paid sick days is actually pretty comparable compared to many other states. So, you know, we have a sizable population here that does not have paid sick days. And if we were to be looking just at low-wage workers, if we were looking at workers in the service industry particularly, that number is probably higher than 7 in 10. So it's a considerable population that are vulnerable.
Now, Professor, Chicago did pass a measure requiring paid sick leave. What effect has that had on the numbers statewide?
Well, look, clearly Chicago's ordinance does provide substantial improvement, and the ordinance is a ordinance that really covers all firms. So Chicago took a step in the right direction and certainly does improve the record in Illinois. And in fact, factoring in the coverage in Chicago would reduce that number that I just cited. So that's an important clarification to make. But keep in mind that, I mean, that law was recently passed. Cook County, of course, has their own ordinance, but many jurisdiction chose to opt out. So to know exactly what that number is probably going to require just a bit more analysis. But clearly, Chicago took a big step forward in reducing the number of workers who aren't entitled to any paid sick days.
Christopher, let's take a look at things nationally. Where do things stand with workers having paid sick leave, and how do things compare here in the United States, say, to some other countries around the world?
Sure. So So just to clarify, the figure is roughly a quarter of American workers do not have paid sick leave.
Gotcha.
But as Professor Bruno mentioned, if you look at particular sectors, especially the service sector, restaurant workers, and especially part-time and low-wage workers, that figure gets much, much higher. Now, the United States is truly unique and exceptional among the world's wealthy countries. We are one of the only countries in the world that does not mandate paid sick leave on any level. And so as a result, you know, we have much higher percentages of people without sick leave. We're hearing lots of stories now about people, particularly in the service sectors, the people who handle our food, who take care of our children, who clean our workplaces and homes. They're having to make a very wrenching choice between getting paid and going to work sick or staying at home and trying to get healthy. It's a real challenge for us.
Professor Bruno, say a worker gets sick here in Illinois and they have to be out for 2 weeks, but their employer does not have sick leave. Are there any federal or state protections in place for those workers?
Well, if the worker is in a enterprise that is covered under the Family Medical Leave Act, the federal law that provides up to 6 months of unpaid leave, then they could have some job protection. But if they don't otherwise have any earned income, any earned paid time off through their employer, then that would be time in which they're off work, but they have no earnings. Now, the Chicago ordinance does intersect with the federal with FMLA, and there's a way in which coverage is provided. But outside of Chicago, if workers aren't getting it through their employer, the federal law, again, only if it applies to the kinds of workplaces that they're in and that they've worked enough hours consistently over a period of time, all they're going to get is job protection, but not necessarily any income while they're off. So frankly, without some state or city provision, folks are going to be they're going to go without income and therefore, for the most part, have a difficult time using that unpaid leave.
Christopher, how much of an impact do you think paid sick leave policy in the U.S. will have on the spread of the coronavirus here?
You know, it's impossible to say for sure. The one thing I can say is that if you talk to public health experts, they say unequivocally that it will make it worse. There was one expert, a PhD student at MIT, who recently said the absence of paid sick days will create, quote, a near guarantee that workers will defy public health warnings and trudge into their workplaces regardless of symptoms. The CDC has studied this in past epidemics like H1N1 and the bird flu, and you know they've pulled out numbers like, you know, in some of these epidemics we have millions upon millions of more people sick simply because of people going to work sick. And they've also tried to run the numbers to figure out what kind of savings we might get if we did provide sick leave. And of course, employers, when they're thinking about sick leave, they're focused on their immediate bottom line, the cost of paying a worker to stay at home. That's very salient. You can calculate that right away. But when you look across the economy, the CDC has calculated that if we had paid sick leave nationwide, overall workplaces would save about $1 to $2 billion each year relative to what they're currently spending. So looking at the broader picture, there's real economic savings to be associated with paid sick time.
Yeah, and one thing that noting here in the state of Illinois, the General Assembly has introduced some paid sick leave legislation in the past, but it's never passed both chambers. It's also faced some opposition from business groups. For example, National Federation of Independent Business Illinois State Director Mark Grant has said that there are other things coming for small businesses like minimum wage hikes in the state that it could be difficult for small business owners to afford additionally offering some paid sick leave. I'd like to hear from both of you on that. Christopher, let's start with you. What does the data show? Could small businesses be able to handle something like this?
Yeah, well, it depends on how the program is structured, right? There are other countries do this in lots of different ways. Some countries, they have, you know, they have extra tax payments going in to afford these, or, you know, federal governments chip in a certain percentage. It all depends on how you structure this. Of course, you can structure this in a way that small businesses will be able to handle. They do it in literally every other country in the world. In fact, one of the most interesting things I found out recently is that the United States, you know, we often talk about our small business environment, how we say we're open for business, we're pro-business, but we have some of the lowest rates of small business formation in the world. And that is due to things to our attitudes like not only just health insurance coverage, but also sick time and how we treat our workers and how we handle people who need to be out of work. So, you know, I'm starting to think of this less in terms of the question of can we afford paid sick days and more in terms of the question of can we not afford paid sick days, especially at a time of coronavirus.
Professor Bruno, your thoughts?
Yeah. So I think a little bit of history of social policy would be helpful here. And you can go back really to the progressive era where there are discussions about increasing social welfare and addressing policies in the workplace to create some kind of a standard, some sort of floor. And incrementally, while the U.S. is certainly well behind other industrialized democracies in creating protective measures for people at work, we have made, you know, some incremental changes like minimum wage, workers' compensation, and such. And whenever such a policy's been proposed, and this is true of any kind of a healthcare policy, go back to Truman talking about universal healthcare. But whenever such a policy is discussed, typically there is a significant pushback that comes from the private sector, that comes from the business community, from conservative political groups claiming that the sky is going to fall. This was said about Medicaid. This was said about Medicare. This was said about Social Security. And in every single case, the sky not only didn't fall, but firms were competitive. The economy grew strong. And life went on, and conditions were incrementally improved. And if you just looked at what has been done in those cities that have passed paid parental leave laws, or the few states that have done so, and looked at the numbers and the reports that have been done there, what you find is employers aren't being burdened. Turnover has dropped. The savings to the firms have been significant. And the economic harm that is always thrown up is really a red herring, and there's simply no support amongst the history of social policy for such things, and there's no reason to believe this would be any different in this particular case.
Christopher, back to you here. There's been a lot of discussion with the flu in relation to this. Obviously, they're different illnesses, but I understand you looked into the relationship between mandatory paid sick leave and flu rates. What did researchers find in cities that have established mandatory paid sick leave?
Yeah, there was this really interesting study recently done. As Dr. Bruno has mentioned, a number of big cities in the past decade or so, they've started to just go ahead and implement their own pay leave policies because they see a need for it. These researchers that studied it, they looked at cities that did implement these policies versus similar cities that did not. What they found was that in cities that did these policies, when you had a flu outbreak after the policy went into effect, that outbreak was up to 40% less severe. So you're talking many thousands, even millions of fewer patients infected with the flu in cities that implemented these policies. So certainly from a public health angle, if paid sick days, if you look at them as a tool to reduce infection rates among the population, the data says they are great for doing that.
And Professor Bruno, I'm curious, you know, you're talking about some past policies, more progressive policies that have been implemented for businesses, in terms of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. As you look at something like mandatory paid sick leave here, what do you think might be the best way to implement something like this where it would be able to be implemented without having a negative effect on small businesses?
Well, I think it would be a good idea to certainly learn from what has occurred in other jurisdictions, take a good hard look at how they have structured paid parental leave, how they have funded it. In a number of cases, there have been the application of a small payroll tax that has funded it. So I think we can look at some of this past social policy. I think we can actually talk about it from the perspective of what's good for the general well-being. We can talk about it as important to health care and well-being so that people really understand the need to give workers this opportunity to take care of themselves when they're sick. And I think making an equity argument, frankly, Brian, as we've talked about, you know, large Fortune 500 companies, big companies, people holding professional occupations are far more likely to have paid time off. But when we're talking about folks who are, you know, being paid somewhere between the minimum wage up to about the median wage, they're far less likely to have these kinds of benefits. And those workers tend to be people of color. Many of them are women, and they are the people who really provide us with the services that help to support and fuel the ability of our economy to run day in and day out. So I think talking about it as a moral issue, as an equity issue, as a healthcare issue, and then also appreciating that it doesn't do economic harm, and then borrowing from what other states have done, and putting together a program that could be incrementally improved upon. Or we could look at the possibility of creating public options. The state of Illinois could look at, well, what would a public option-like plan be? What would the effect be like? We could model that out. We could look at what was once called Romney Care before it became Obamacare in Massachusetts. We can look at what other states have attempted to do and put those into effect. And it strikes me that's a holistic strategy that can make the best case for overcoming some political opposition.
Robert Bruno is a professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois. Christopher Ingram, a data reporter with the Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Early voting is well underway across the state of Illinois for the primary election taking place 1 week from today. There are contested races in several congressional districts in the election, and today we wanted to take a closer look at two of them. The 17th Congressional District stretches from the Quad Cities to the west, up to Rockford and down to parts of Peoria. That seat has been held by Democrat Sherry Bustos of East Moline since voters first elected her in 2012. Here to discuss that race with us is Tim Shelley. He is the news director for Peoria Public Radio. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brian.
Tim, as I mentioned, Democrat Sherry Bustos is the incumbent in the 17th District. Does she have a primary challenger this year?
So it's kind of an interesting situation. She had a primary challenger who's actually Spanky Edwards, the head of the Peoria ACLU. However, he was removed from the ballot after a petition challenge. He's currently running a write-in campaign against Sherry Bustos, but she is the only named person on the ballot on the Democratic side.
Okay. On the Republican side, we do have a contested race there. Who's running for the chance to face Bustos this fall?
So we've got two currently. One is Esther Joy King, who is an attorney up in East Moline. She's also a captain in the Army Reserve, first-time candidate. She's challenged by Bill Faywell, who was the candidate in 2018. One thing to remember about Faywell, he was initially supported by the Illinois Republican Party in 2018 until some posts came out that he had made on social media regarding the September 11th terrorist attacks and a couple other issues, which proved controversial. They then publicly pulled back their support, and they have also not endorsed anybody in this primary.
Now, there was a third candidate on the ballot at one time. Is that right?
That's correct. Eugene Farrell from Roseville was on the ballot. There was a bit of confusion with him. So what he actually did, he withdrew from the ballot, and it was registered by the Illinois State Board of Elections. However, he then came back and said that there had been an error in the withdrawal process, so he was still on the ballot. So there was a little bit of confusion about that for a while. He's since completely dropped out of the running and endorsed Bill Faywell.
And you mentioned that Faywell, at least for a time last election cycle, did have support from the state Republican Party. Has the party thrown its support behind any of the candidates this time around?
Not explicitly on the state level. On the national level, Esther Joy King has gotten a couple big endorsements. Dan Crenshaw from Texas, up in rising star in the National Republican Party. Also, Senator Tom Cotton has endorsed her as well. So she does have some major national backing behind her, but explicitly the on the national or the state levels, there has been no official party endorsement in this race so far.
Now, Tim, you attended a candidates forum for this race back in January. Were there any issues where you saw differences of opinion among the candidates?
There are a few. I would say one is probably health care. Both candidates in the race do support, retracting what is the Affordable Care Act. Esther Joy King is in favor of protecting pre-existing conditions. Both candidates are would revoke Roe versus Wade, which is the 1973 decision which legalized abortion nationwide. They both support the president on most policies, I would say. But I would say kind of the difference between them comes in Faywell is kind of running as a anti-establishment candidate. He says that he is not, because he's not backed by the state or national Republican parties, that he is the better candidate. He's actually trying to use some of those endorsements that Esther Joy King has received against her as kind of running against the establishment. So it's an interesting dynamic. Esther Joy King is she is currently advertising on the radio here in Peoria. I've heard a couple radio ads from her, and she's definitely running as somebody who's portraying themselves as a kind of the more mainstream Republican candidate.
Tim, the 17th district is one of the few in the country that voted for President Trump in 2016 while also electing a Democrat to Congress. Have you seen the Republican Party making a big push to try to swing this seat back their way?
Surprisingly, no, not really. Back in 2018, there was a businessman from Galesburg by the name of Mark Klein who was backed by the RNC. However, he dropped out of the race, and Bill Faywell became the presumptive nominee, Klein stating that he had some issues with how the National Party was attempting to run his campaign. So in 2020, Sherry Bustos, it's also worth mentioning, is the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, whose job it is to try to get Democrats elected to the House nationwide. So she has a pretty substantial war chest. So neither Republican candidate has raised nearly that much. So though it's a district that can go Republican, it voted for Bobby Schilling, who was a Tea Party candidate back in 2010. It does not look like there's a lot of money being invested into this race by the Republican Party on the national level to try to take this seat.
Tim Shelley is the news director with Peoria Public Radio covering the 17th District Republican primary race. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
Illinois' 15th Congressional District, meanwhile, makes up of all of 29 counties and parts of four more. It stretches from portions of the St. Louis Metro east, southeast to the Kentucky border, and north to Danville on the Indiana border. That seat is open after 12-term Congressman John Shimkus announced his retirement last year, and it's drawn a lot of interest from both parties. Jim Meadows is here to discuss that primary race. He's the senior reporter for WIOL's Illinois Newsroom in Urbana. Jim, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Jim, unlike the 17th district, there's not much doubt about where Illinois' 15th district has lined up politically, at least recently. It's been pretty solidly Republican, right?
I would say it was designed to elect Republicans, or rather, I should say, districts next to it were designed to elect Democrats, and they've taken the urban areas where those Democrats might be most likely to reside.
So just to kind of reiterate that, what, about 70% last time voted for Representative Shimkus on the Republican side?
That's right. The year before that, he had no Democratic opposition, or rather the election before that.
Now, you interviewed all eight candidates running for this seat, four from each party. Let's start with the Republicans. Who's running for that nomination?
Well, among the Republicans, we have Dr. Charles Ellington, Chuck Ellington. He's a family physician in Camargo in the northern part of the district with his medical practice in Arthur. Mary Miller is from rural Oakland in Coles County. She's married to State Representative Chris Miller. They manage their farm together, and Mary also has a degree in elementary education and is active in homeschooling, teaching children through a network of homeschools. Those are both first-time candidates. Carrie Wolf is on the school board in Altamont in Effingham County. He is the second, rather, he grew up on a farm. Darren Duncan is a farmer. From Rossville in Vermilion County. He is also the Vermilion County Treasurer.
Now, in speaking with the Republican candidates, are there any issues that seem to separate them at all?
There really doesn't seem much daylight between them. They are all avid supporters of President Trump and his policies. They all are, for instance, against abortion. They are for the Second Amendment. They support a secure border with Mexico. They are all interested in health care, but they are not supporters of the Affordable Care Act. Would like to get rid of it or change it or change it dramatically.
You know, in a district where President Trump is very popular, did any of them show any signs of disagreement with him?
No, I think they're really competing to be in agreement with him.
On the Democratic side, there are also four candidates running for that nomination. Can you tell us who they are?
Well, they include Kevin Gaither of Charleston, who was the challenger to Congressman Shimkus in 2018, winning 29.1% of the vote. Erica Weaver of Mattoon. She is a public defender for Coles County. She serves on the Mattoon School Board and is the only African-American in the race. John W. Hersey of Collinsville, down in the Metro East suburbs of St. Louis. He is a high school English teacher. And Craig Morton, Dr. Craig Morton, a pharmacist in Salem, where he also serves on the city council.
Now, one of the divides within the Democratic Party has been on health care. The more progressive wing of the party is pushing for a single-payer Medicare for All program, while moderates in the party want a public option, which would allow people to buy into Medicare without employer-provided private health insurance being eliminated. Where do Democrats in the 15th district race stand on that issue?
Well, I would say that of the four, the only one to be clearly in favor of a Medicare for All or single-payer type of strategy is John W. Hersey of Collinsville. He is a self-described progressive Democrat, and he says that's the way to go. Others, I was at a candidate forum in Charleston where this specific question came up. They don't necessarily hate Medicare for All, but they just don't see it as being workable. So they're staying away for it for that reason. At least that's how they discussed it in front of an audience of Democrats.
And Jim, with the 2020 census upon us, there's been talk that the 15th congressional district could be absorbed by other downstate districts if Illinois loses a congressional seat. What effect, if any, has that had on this race?
Well, the effect is that we are seeing the less experienced, less well-funded candidates running. There were several more experienced politicians, many on the state legislature, like Mike Maron from Vermilion County, and Jason Plummer, who both considered running for this race, but ultimately decided not to. And at the same time, there's just a lot less money in the candidates' campaign chests. The two candidates who have any sort of money at all are Mary Miller and Darren Duncan. They both have over $200,000 raised so far, compared to as cited by the Open Secrets website. Compare that to the leading candidates in the 13th district, Rodney Davis and Betsy Dirksen Londrigan, who both have $1 or $2 million.
Now, with this seat historically being very solidly on the Republican side, what did the Democrats running have to say about how they thought they could win?
I don't know if any of them actually think they can win. I hear them say things like that. Jem W. Hersey is one who specifically says there's a way to flip the 15th district, and it's by his strategy of running what he calls a values-based rather than an issues-based campaign. But they all have less money than the least well-funded Republican in the race, and it's just not a district that's known to elect Democrats. So I'm not saying it wouldn't happen. It would just be a very unusual event if a Democrat were to win.
Jim, as I mentioned, you interviewed all 8 of these candidates running in the primary election. If people are interested in finding those conversations, where do they go?
They go to IllinoisNewsroom.org, where we have interviews with all 8 of them and also the two Democrats running in the primary for the 13th district.
That's Jim Meadows, senior reporter for WIOL's Illinois Newsroom, discussing the 15th congressional primary race. And again, the primary election 1 week from today. Early voting is open right now. All this week, we've been exploring how the coronavirus is affecting our state. Yesterday, we spoke with Julie Pride from the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District and Monica Hendrickson from the Peoria County Health Department about some of the challenges their organizations are dealing with amidst concerns over COVID-19. At this point, we know there are some actions that are not being advised, like stocking up on face masks. We actually got a question from a listener about this through our website, askthenewsroom.org. Kimberly wants to know why the general public is being told not to use masks because they don't protect people from getting sick. At the same time, we're hearing healthcare workers need them. She says, quote, "Why is it that masks work for a person if they're a doctor or a nurse, but not for the people in the general public?" For help answering this question, we reached out to Dr. Michael Eisen. He's a professor of infectious diseases and organ transplantation at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Here's what he had to say.
I think this is a very important question that a lot of people may have. Part of the reason why there's differential recommendations for mask use depends on the reason why the individuals are using them. Public people wearing a mask where they are not coming in close contact and frequent contact with sick patients really provides very little benefit to the recipient. Additionally, it uses masks that can't be used by people doing risky things in the hospital or coming in regular contact with patients that are known to have infection. On the other hand, staff in the hospital that are wearing masks are in direct contact with someone that they know has or strongly suspect have COVID-19. They may be doing things that generate aerosols, like swabbing their nose or getting sputum from the patients. And as a result, the mask does provide protection for the individuals. Additionally, individuals in the hospital oftentimes are using N95 masks, those masks that are specially designed to prevent aerosol transmissions from viruses that may be in the air and not droplets. It's this reason that it's helpful for helping to protect healthcare workers and likely of little benefit to the public wearing them without significant close contact with known patients with COVID-19.
Again, that was Northwestern University's Dr. Michael Eisen. If you have questions about the coronavirus or how Illinois is dealing with it, you can submit them to askthenewsroom.org, and we'll do our best to get them answered. Again, that's askthenewsroom.org. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from 2 Illinois Poet Laureates. I'm Brian Moline. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Illinois has been home to some of America's great poets, Carl Sandburg and Gwendolyn Brooks, who was the first African-American woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize for Literature. They were also both Illinois Poet Laureates, who worked to make the art of poetry more accessible to people in their everyday lives. Two Illinois towns, Urbana and Aurora, recently appointed their own poet laureates for the first time. WNIJ's Jenna Dooley recently sat down with Kevin Stein, who was poet laureate of Illinois from 2003 to 2017 and was a professor of English at Bradley University, to ask him about the role and to do a reading. She started by asking him how he viewed his role as the state's poet laureate.
Kevin, can you walk through what your duties were while you were state poet laureate?
The state poet laureate's position is an odd one in a way, because there's no stipend, no project budget, no travel budget, and therefore the state seems to sort of appoint one and then turn their back on you to some degree. The good part of that is that one can create a program, an agenda of one's own devices. And so I did just that, and I worked using the model of Gwendolyn Brooks, the activist laureate that she was. I also tried to put poetry in places that it wasn't expected. So I presented nearly 250 events in schools, libraries, book clubs, universities. I read a poetry sermon from the pulpit of a Unitarian church. I read at a factory, several nursing homes, did a lot of judging and that sort of thing. So the activist laureate role was to put poetry in places where people didn't necessarily expect to find it. I also started a couple of websites because I know I can't get there everywhere, and I wanted to bring the poet laureateship into the 21st century. And so I maintained a stable of great audio and video poems of Illinois poets presenting their work and youth poetry and the like. And we also sponsored a emerging poets competition with the Secretary of State's office and the Illinois State Library. Did that for 16 years, and that contest is still underway. And many of our winners of that competition have gone on to publish a full-length collection. So that's just been really gratifying for me. I also co-sponsored a grade, middle, and high school poetry competition with the Illinois Association of Teachers of English. So we tried to support youth poetry in all ways. And so we really tried to find ways to extend what Ms. Brooks did, because she was amazing, and then to add our own flourishes along the way.
Let's talk about those Illinois poets. What contribution has Illinois made to poetry, either recently or throughout the state's history?
The 20th and 21st centuries have been notable, frankly, beginning with someone like Carl Sandburg over 100 and some years ago. He introduced us to the notion of income inequality, if you will, through his populist work. And we also, Ms. Brooks, Gwendolyn Brooks, was the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize, a notable achievement. There's the Chicago Renaissance, the Poetry Magazine, the Poetry Foundation in Chicago, with an international venue for poetry, publishing T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound early on. In more recent times, we've had Mark Smith, who created the Poetry Slam, and that Poetry Slam is now a worldwide phenomenon. Liesl Mueller, a wonderful poet who just passed, unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks. Ms. Mueller was an immigrant fleeing with her family, Nazi Germany, learned to write poetry in what she called her second language, and won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. You have a gaggle of really talented and thoughtful poets in the state currently, and you have a vibrant history of Illinois poetry in the past.
I'm thinking, too, of Vachel Lindsay, who founded Singing Poetry.
That's exactly the case. And of course, our first poet laureate, Howard Austin, was famous for impromptu poems that involved a kind of early kind of performance poetry. He would go to Governor Horner's as political smokers, observe and listen, and then he and his quartet would perform the poem that he wrote. So he was, as with Lindsay, an early forerunner and a kind of poetry that was to be performed and received in front of an audience, as opposed to being published only in a book.
Well, you mentioned performance, and I don't want to make you sing, because that's not your style of poetry, but I was wondering if you could do a reading for us.
Well, I'd be pleased to. And what I'll do is read you a short poem titled "A Poem Buried in a Time Capsule to be Unearthed in April 2097. And this poem comes about from my being asked right after I got to Bradley University, where I taught for my career in Illinois, being asked to donate one of my early books to this time capsule. And I donated the book and I slipped this poem under the front cover without anybody knowing. So, poem buried in a time capsule to be unearthed in April 2097. Citizens, what did you find when awakened this morning? Your sky as blue as ours, a few sparrows rustling among lime green leaves of April maples, all people fed and housed and free. This would be the great blessing, though a far greater surprise.
Thank you so much for sharing that poetry. And what I love about the poem you read is it leaves a legacy too. Decades and decades from now, when that actually takes effect, it'll be interesting to see how the audience receives your words. I want to get to poet laureates in communities. Urbana, Illinois, and Aurora recently appointed their very first poet laureates. What do you see as the value of having someone in this position in a smaller town?
This is good news. And I know that Karen Christensen was just appointed in Aurora, and I didn't know about Urbana until our conversation. I'm delighted to hear that. Essentially, when you have a local or community poet laureate, you have in place an ambassador for poetry, someone to bring the pleasures of poetry to fresh audiences, as well as someone to heighten current devotees' appreciation of the art form. So you have a double function of teacher, cajoler. I suppose you become the aesthetic huckster, and you try to introduce folks to things that might scare them. And oftentimes, language in the poem are an object of some concern to readers who aren't familiar, perhaps. They haven't read a lot of poems. Perhaps their experience in school was not the most positive one in receiving poetry. So what you have, essentially, in a community poet laureate, you're showing belief in poetry's public function. And I think that's really important. Right now, there is so much interest, a real surge of interest among young folks, spoken word and performance poets, and those poets understand quite clearly the link between the personal and the communal and the private and the public. And to me, that's good for the culture as a whole and good for the individual as well.
That's Kevin Stein, the Illinois Poet Laureate from 2003 to 2017. Kevin, thanks for talking with us on the 21st.
Well, thanks for asking me. I really enjoyed it.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation now, Karen Follett Christensen, who was recently appointed as the City of Aurora's first poet laureate. She's a retired city worker and has written more than 3,000 poems. Karen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
How do you view your role as the poet laureate of Aurora?
I feel very strongly that I'm an ambassador for poetry. And the best thing that's happened to me so far since I was installed in the middle of January is because I worked for the city for 13 years, I have a lot of connections in the community. And so people already knew who I was, which I suspect may have contributed to why I was appointed. And so wherever I go now, people are asking me about poetry. It's just really wonderful.
I also heard, though, that you strongly considered not applying.
I did. I was actually a little bit skeptical about what the purpose of this was going to be. I didn't want, I knew that whomever was appointed was going to have to devote a fair amount of time to this. And I'm already involved in a lot of organizations as a volunteer. But I wanted to make sure in my own mind that the city was really serious about this and it wasn't just something that was going to be done to add another special name, you know, to things that the city was already doing.
And you felt like the application really spoke to you.
It did. I was really impressed. In fact, I waited almost till the very last minute to even look at the application, but I did. And I realized as I started to go through the questions that a significant amount of thought had gone into this. And then after I submitted the application, when I sat for an interview with the mayor, Mayor Richard Irvin, and the city's public information officer, Clayton Muhammad, we talked for well over an hour. And any skepticism that I had was gone after I heard them talk about what they wanted this role to encompass.
Let's dig into your love of poetry. Was there an Illinois poet who inspired you to start writing?
Well, of course, Gwendolyn Brooks. I grew up in Chicago, and I knew about her even when I was in high school. I'm 69 years old, so I was in high school from 64 through 68. And then I actually went to Northern Illinois University, where I graduated. But I think also, having grown up in Chicago and being exposed to a lot of the music and art and so on that was going on during the 60s in Chicago, I was hearing poetry everywhere. I had been a big fan of the Beats, even when I was in high school. I was fortunate that I had an English teacher who was pretty progressive and exposed us to those writers, despite the fact that maybe they were considered a little marginal. The fact that I grew up during the generation when there were so many singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and Donovan, you know, that was all part of my high school experience. And I actually played folk guitar when I was in high school. So I was being inundated, if you will, with words. So it wasn't hard then to say, oh, I think maybe I'd like to try my hand at this.
We just heard a poem from former Illinois poet laureate Kevin Stein, and I'm wondering if you could share some of your work with us and read one of your poems.
I should, or rather I could. I'm going to read for you a poem called Why Poetry. We need to speak all the words that connect us, one to another. Sometimes we need to sing those words. Sometimes we need to dance those words. Sometimes we need to paint those words. No matter, our hearts know they yearn for release, a demand that comes with being human. Our hearts can burst unless we nurture the power to share. We crave mirrors reflecting our faces. We pound drums that will resonate. Our feelings were never meant for containment. If we lock them down, cover them over, press them flat, they rise up to hurt us and those around us. If we let them out, they color the world. They soften the hardships. They transform into love.
Beautiful. And optimistic as well.
Yeah. Good. Glad that you think so.
That was WNIJ's Jenna Dooley speaking with Aurora's first poet laureate, appointed in January, Karen Follett Christensen. Earlier, she was joined by former poet laureate of Illinois, Kevin Stein. A reminder that all this week we're answering your questions about the coronavirus. If you have a question you'd like us to answer, just go to askthenewsroom.org and we'll get right on it. That's all the time we have for today. Follow us on Twitter, search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moldine. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.